Random House Audiobooks presents How to Talk to Anyone, Anytime, Anywhere. The Secrets of Good Communication by Larry King with Bill Gilbert. Read for you by Larry King.
How to talk to anyone, anytime, anywhere. The secrets of good conversation. Talking's like playing golf, driving a car, or owning a store. The more you do it, the better you get at it, the more fun you have doing it. But first, you have to understand the fundamentals. I've been fortunate to have achieved a certain level of success in talking, maybe enough so that as you're listening to this tape, you're thinking to yourself, sure, he can say talking is fun. He's good at it. Well, it's true that talking has come naturally to me, but even those who have a natural ability for something have to work to develop it. That's what turns a talent into a skill. Ted Williams, the best baseball hitter I ever saw and a man blessed with more natural ability than anyone in my lifetime, took batting practice every day like everybody else. Luciano Pavarotti was born with a wonderful voice, but he still took singing lessons. I have a natural ability and inclination to talk, but I've had plenty of moments when talk didn't come easy. If you could have been a fly on the wall in a Miami Beach radio studio 37 years ago and witnessed my first morning in broadcasting, you'd have bet the ranch that it was the last morning in broadcasting. It happened at station WAHR, a small radio station across the street from a police station on First Street, just off Washington Boulevard, on the morning of May 1st, 1957. I'd been there 3 weeks, hanging around, hoping to crash into my dream world of radio. The station's general manager, Marshall Simmons, told me he liked my voice, another thing I can't take any credit for, but he didn't have any openings. That didn't discourage me. I was willing to take my chances, and I told him so. He said, fine, if I hung around, I'd get the job the next time he had an opening. I went to the station every day. I watched the disc jockeys on the air, the newscasters reporting the news, the sportscasters giving sports results. I watched in silent fascination for the first time as I saw stories come over AP and UPI wires. I wrote a few little stories myself, hoping somebody would use them on the air. Suddenly, after 3 weeks, the morning disc jockey quit. Marshall called me into his general manager's office on a Friday and told me that I had the job starting at 9 o'clock Monday morning. I'd make $55 a week. I'd be on from 9 until noon Monday through Friday. In the afternoon, I would do newscasts and sportscasts until getting off at 5. My dream had come true. Not only was I getting on the radio, I was going to be on for 3 hours at a time every morning, plus another half dozen times or so every afternoon. I was going to be on the air as often as Arthur Godfrey, superstar at CBS. I didn't sleep the whole weekend. I kept rehearsing things to say on the air. By 8:30 of that first morning, I was a basket case. I was drinking coffee and water for the dryness in my mouth and throat. I had the record with my theme song, Les Elgart, swinging down the lane with me, ready to cue it up on the turntable as soon as I went into the studio. In the meantime, I was getting more nervous by the minute. Then Marshall Simmons called me into his office to wish me good luck. After I thanked him, he asked me, what name are you going to use? I said, what are you talking about? He says, well, you can't use Larry Zeiger. It's ethnic. People won't be able to spell it or remember it. You need a better name. You are not going to use Larry Zeiger. He had the Miami Herald open on his desk, and there was a full-page ad for King's Wholesale Liquors. Marshall looked down and said simply, how about Larry King? Okay, fine. That's your name, Larry King. You will host the Larry King Show. So there I was, a new job, a new show, a new theme song, a new name. The news came on at 9. I sat in the studio with Swinging Down the Lane queued up, ready to broadcast the Larry King Show to a waiting world. My mouth felt like cotton. As my own engineer, which is always the case at a small station, I started the theme. The music came on. Then I faded the music down so I could talk. Only nothing came out. So I bring the music back up again and fade it again. Still no words come out of my mouth. It happens a third time. The only thing my listeners are hearing is a record going up and down in volume, unaccompanied by any human voice. I can still remember saying to myself that I'd been wrong, that I was a street gabber, but I wasn't ready to do this professionally. I knew I'd love this line of work, but clearly I wasn't ready for it. I didn't have the guts to do it. Finally, Marshall Simmons, the man who'd been so kind in giving me such a tremendous opportunity, exploded, as only general managers can explode. He kicked open the door to the control room with his foot and said five words to me, loud and clear. "This is a communications business." Then he turned and left, slamming the door behind him. In that instance, I leaned forward toward the microphone and said the first words I ever spoke as a broadcaster. "Good morning. This is my first day ever on the radio. I've always wanted to be on the air. I've been practicing all weekend. 15 minutes ago, they gave me a new name. I've had my theme song ready to play, but my mouth is dry and I'm nervous." And the general manager just kicked open the door and said, "This is a communications business." Being able to say at least something gave me the confidence to go on, and the rest of the show went fine. That was the beginning of my career in talking. I was never nervous on the radio again. I learned something about talking that morning in Miami Beach, whether you're on the air or off. Be honest. You can never go wrong in broadcasting or in any area of speech. Arthur Godfrey told me the same thing about how to be a successful broadcaster. Let your listeners and viewers share your experiences and how you feel. I think one reason I've had a certain amount of success in broadcasting is that the audience can see that I love what I'm doing. You can't fake that. If you try, you will fail. If you really do love what you're doing and project that enthusiasm to the people you're talking to, your chances for success become greater. President Clinton's a prime example of this. Just before we taped an interview in the White House for my nightly CNN show, on the anniversary of his first year in office, the president told me, "The best day of my life is being president on a good day. And the second best day of my life is being president on a bad day." Bill Clinton's a good talker and a wonderful guest because he has great enthusiasm for his job and he communicates it in his talk. That enthusiasm and his willingness to share it has obviously made him not just successful as a talker, but rather successful in his chosen career. The right attitude, the will to talk, even when it might not be comfortable at first, is another basic ingredient for becoming a better talker. When I managed to survive that case of mic fright, I made a commitment to myself that I was going to do two things. One, I was going to keep right on talking. Two, I was going to improve my ability to talk by working at it hard. What did I do? Everything. I hosted the morning show. I did the weather. I filled in the afternoon sports reports, the business reports. I anchored the news. I gave speeches. If somebody called in sick or wanted a day off, I worked a double shift. Getting better at talking is the same as getting better at anything else. The more you do it, the better you get at it. So I grabbed every opportunity I could to do as much talking on the air as possible. My objective was to be on the air and to be a success at it. In addition to consulting books and now videos on how to talk, there's a lot you can do yourself. You can talk out loud to yourself around your house or apartment. I do. Not often, I hasten to add, but sometimes. I live alone, so from time to time, I'll say a few words off the cuff or try out something I might want to say later in a speech or on one of my shows. There's no reason for me to feel embarrassed about it because there's nobody else around anyhow. You can do the same thing, even if you don't live alone. Go into a room by yourself or into a basement. Just wait until the others have gone to the store or out for the night, and then practice talking better. You can stand in front of a mirror and talk to the image. This is a common technique, especially for people trying to improve their ability as public speakers. But it works for everyday conversation, too. And it helps you to train yourself to use good eye-to-eye contact because you're looking automatically at the image across from you, your reflection in the mirror. Besides the willingness to work on it, you need at least two other ingredients to be a good conversationalist: a sincere interest in the other person and an openness to them about yourself, like the kind I tried to convey on that first paralyzing Miami Beach morning. I think it's apparent to viewers of my nightly talk show on CNN that I'm interested in my guests. I am sure to look them right in the eye, make sure of doing it, and then I lean forward in my chair and I ask them a question, always about their interests. I respect everyone on my shows, from presidents and Hall of Fame athletes to Kermit the Frog and Miss Piggy of the Muppets, and yes, I've had them on too. You cannot talk to people successfully if they think you're not interested in what they have to say, or you have no respect for them. I remember something Will Rogers once said. Everybody is ignorant, only on different subjects. It's worth remembering this whether you're talking to one person on your way to work or to a TV guest in front of an audience of 10 million. The corollary of this is everybody is an expert on something. They've got at least one subject they love to talk about. Always respect that expertise. Your listener or listeners will always be able to tell whether you respect them. If they feel you do, they will listen more attentively as you talk. If they don't, nothing you say or do will win them back to what you're talking about. The remaining ingredient in my formula for success is an openness about yourself while you're talking to others, like my candor with my audience when I developed that severe case of mic fright my first morning on the air. We all know the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. It applies to conversation, too. You should be as open and honest as possible with your conversational partners as you'd want them to be with you. Telling people what your background is and what your likes and dislikes are is part of the give and take of conversation. It's how we get to know people. Regis Philbin and Kathy Lee Gifford are good examples of talkers who exhibit an openness about themselves when they're talking to their guests. They come into your room easily, naturally, and they're not afraid to exhibit their tastes or to tell stories about themselves. Without making themselves the focus of their talk, they are themselves. They don't try to fake it. If their story or their guest produces a sentimental tone or some other kind of emotion, they're not ashamed to show their feelings. Regis and Kathy Lee obviously know there's nothing wrong with showing a sentimental side. If it's a sentimental moment or fear or sadness or whatever the story or the guest might involve, the audiences in the studio and at home see that and relate to their openness and their obvious genuineness. Whether the setting is social or professional, one of the first things to be accomplished in talking to people is to put them at ease. Most of us are naturally shy, and believe me, shyness I know. A Jewish kid from Brooklyn who wears glasses knows shy. And all of us tend to be nervous, or at least on edge, when we're talking to someone we haven't met before or talking in public for the first time. The best way I've found to overcome shyness is to remind yourself of the old saying that the person you're talking to puts his pants on one leg at a time. Sure, it's a cliché, but like most clichés, it happens to be true, which, of course, is why they became clichés in the first place. It's worth remembering that almost all of us started out the same way. Very few of us are born to wealth and power unless you're a Kennedy or a Rockefeller or a member of one of a select group of few families. Most of us started out as children of middle-income families or less. We worked part-time to pay for college or while getting started in our careers. And chances are the people we're talking to did, too. Now, maybe we're not as rich and as famous as they are or as successful in our field, but we probably come from fundamentally the same backgrounds, so we can relate as brothers and sisters. You don't have to stand there feeling inferior or intimidated. You belong in that room just as much as the person you're talking to. It also helps you to overcome your shyness if you remember that the person you're talking to is probably just as shy as you are. Most of us are. Reminding yourself of this will do wonders for your ability to shed your own shyness. Whether you're at a party, dinner, meeting your new neighbors, in your first day on the job, or in any one of a million different settings, the subjects that you can open a conversation with are almost unlimited. During the 1994 Winter Olympics, unless the person you were talking to just landed from Mars, you could talk about the Tonya Harding-Nancy Kerrigan episode. The weather prompted Mark Twain to complain that everybody talks about it, nobody does anything about it, but the reality is that the weather is always a can't-miss talk concept and completely safe subject for starting a conversation, especially if you know absolutely zero about the other person. Vice President Gore is criticized by some for being too stiff, a wooden personality on TV, although I have never found him that way. But even those who do would see he is a lively, enthusiastic, and animated person if they asked him, say, about the Baltimore Orioles or his school days at St. Albans in Washington when his father was a senator from Tennessee. Now, if you got him talking about his children, you also see a very warm and a very human Al Gore. Any of these subjects would get a conversation with the vice president off to a successful start. Obviously, there are many political subjects he could talk about at length, but it's the things that are closest to him personally that make him open up the most. And that's true for most other people, too. If you're at a party, the occasion itself is often a starting point for talk. When my friends threw a party for my 60th birthday, they called it the 50th anniversary of Larry's 10th birthday, and they gave it a 40s Brooklyn theme. A lot of conversation that night began with the Dodgers, with Coney Island, and other nostalgic topics. If you're at a party in someone's home or even an office, there are likely to be furnishings, mementos that your host will cheerfully talk about. Is there a picture of them in Red Square? Ask him about that trip to Russia. Is there a crayon drawing on the wall? Ask which of their children or grandchildren drew it. My first rule of conversation is this. I never learn a thing while I'm talking. I realize every morning that nothing I say today will teach me anything. So if I'm going to learn a little today, I got to do a lot of listening. As obvious as this sounds, you run across proof every day that people simply don't listen. Tell your family or friends your plane will arrive at 8, and before the conversation ends, they'll ask, "What time did you say your plane was coming?" To be a good talker, you must be a good listener. This is more than just a matter of showing an interest in your conversation partner. Careful listening makes you better able to respond to be a good talker when it's your turn. Good follow-up questions are the mark of a good conversationalist. When I interview guests on the air, I make notes ahead of time about the kinds of questions I'll ask them. But often I'll hear something in one of their responses that leads me into an unexpected question and a surprising answer. Example: when Vice President Quayle was my guest during the 1992 presidential campaign, we talked about the laws governing abortion. He said it made no sense at all for his daughter's school to require his or his wife's permission to miss a day of school, but not to get an abortion. As soon as he said that, I was curious about Quayle's personal angle on this political topic. So I asked what his attitude would be if his daughter said she was going to have an abortion. He said he would support her in whatever decision she made. Quayle's reply made news. Abortion was a white-hot issue in that campaign, and here was President Bush's very conservative running mate, the national Republican spokesman for his conservative wing's unalterable opposition to abortion, suddenly saying that he would support his daughter if she decided to have an abortion. Regardless of your views on that issue, the point here is that it was because I wasn't just going through a list of questions. I was listening to what Quayle was saying. And that was what led me to the newsworthy answer. I have never gone out of my way to study body language, so I don't pretend to be the ultimate authority on it. But there is one rule of body language that you must follow for successful conversation. Make eye contact. Maintaining good eye contact, not just at the beginning and end of your comments, but the whole time you're talking and listening, all go far toward making you a successful talker, wherever you are, whatever the occasion might be, and whoever the other person is. I also lean slightly forward toward the person I'm speaking to emphasize that I'm focusing on them. The key, as I've said before, is listening. If you are really trying to listen to what another person says, you'll find that it's much easier if you look them in the face. In fact, if you're listening closely, most of the appropriate body language will follow automatically. One note about eye contact. Although it's important to make eye contact frequently as you talk, you don't need to stare continuously in the other person's eyes. Many people would find that uncomfortable. You might too. Look your conversation partner in the eye when he is talking. And when you're asking him a question. If you're speaking, you can take your eyes off your partner occasionally. However, don't stare off into space as if he wasn't there. And if you're at a party, don't let your eyes wander over your partner's shoulder as if you're looking for someone more important to talk to. My basic advice on the subject is to worry about how well you're talking and let your body language take care of itself. A new requirement for being a good talker in our culture is staying informed. One of the many profound results of the communications explosions of the last half of the 20th century is that people know more about what's going on in the world. Before World War II, social conversation tended to be less topical than today, simply because people didn't get half as much news and public opinion, and what they did get took a lot longer and came in much smaller doses. Today, they may not know more than a few sentences from the evening news, but regardless of how deep their knowledge is, when the Berlin Wall's torn down, or Nancy Kerrigan gets whacked across the shins, or Frank Sinatra faints on stage, everybody knows it, and almost immediately. To be a successful conversationalist, you have to be able to talk about what's on people's minds, and it may be the subject they just heard about on the radio or saw on the evening news. Social occasions for conversation range from small, comfortable gatherings like a dinner party among friends to big, intimidating crowd scenes like a Washington cocktail party. In between are events like weddings and bar mitzvahs. Each one is different, but the principles of conversation are the same. Be open, find the common ground with your partner, and always listen. Cocktail parties are a difficult challenge for me. I'm happiest talking with people one-on-one, so I find a crowd of people in a noisy room a little overwhelming. I don't drink alcohol. I'm not that big on soft drinks, so I don't have a glass in my hand to use as a prop in conversation. I tend to fold my arms across my chest, which just happens to be comfortable for me, but may make me look less open to starting a conversation. Now, instead of being intimidated by the size of the group, look for someone to have a one-on-one conversation with. I try to pick and choose my spots. Start a conversation with someone who looks alert and interested in the goings-on. Or I discreetly join others in conversations already underway that sound interesting. One trick is to not get caught in the same place for a long period of time. That's where mingling becomes necessary if you are to represent yourself successfully at a cocktail party. Remember, asking questions is the secret of good conversation. I'm curious about everything, and if I'm at a cocktail party, I bring that curiosity with me. I often ask my favorite question, why? If a man tells me that he and his family are moving to another city, why? A woman is changing jobs, why? Someone roots for the Mets, why? On my television show, I probably use that word more than any other. It is the greatest question ever asked, always will be, and it is certainly the surest way of keeping a conversation lively and interesting. If you find yourself stuck with a real bore or simply feel it's time to end a long conversation and move on, there's always one guaranteed way to get out of the conversation. Excuse me, I gotta go to the restroom. If you make it sound urgent enough, no one will take offense at your departure. When you come back, start another conversation, only this time with someone else. Or if you spot someone you know nearby, you can make your escape with, "Stacy, have you met Bill?" As Stacy is shaking hands with Bill, you can say, "I'll be back in a minute, but I know you too have a lot to talk about." At a busy cocktail party, they won't be surprised if you don't come back in a minute. Of course, if your first conversation partner is a killing bore, Stacy may never forgive you. So use this technique with caution. Talk between the sexes, especially between two people who just met, may be the hardest form of talking. It is for me. The way you strike up a conversation with someone of the opposite sex is very different now from when I was growing up. In those days, a guy might walk up to a woman at a cocktail party and say, "What's a nice girl like you doing in a place like this?" Or, "Where have you been all my life?" Lines like that don't work anymore. In fact, the idea of lines seems like a cliche today. If you started off with one of those I just quoted, you'd sound like you're auditioning for the part of a lounge lizard. This is not just a problem for men, of course. For women, too, knowing how to get started talking with a man is difficult. In fact, it's extra difficult for some women because for so long it was a taboo for a woman to approach a man at all. It was okay to initiate small talk at a tea party, but for a single woman to imply to a man that she found him attractive was at best forward, at worst brazen. When I was dating in high school and into my 20s and 30s, it was a serious no-no for a girl even to call a boy or a woman to call a man on the telephone. It just wasn't done. Your parents would tell you, "Nice girls don't call boys. Boys call them." But they didn't really have to tell you that. The girls wouldn't call you anyhow. In those days, a strict, unwritten code governed how young men and women behaved toward each other. Members of the opposite sex never gave each other clothes as gifts, not even a sweater. Well, maybe a necktie or a pair of gloves. Anything else was considered much too personal. Good book, nice wallet, nothing more intimate than that. Young men and women certainly never took overnight trips to the beach or anywhere else, even with their steadies. And the code word said, don't call him. He's supposed to call you. Today, all those taboos are history. The flip side of the change is that women can now agonize just as much as men over how to open a conversation. Arthur Godfrey's advice to me to be yourself may fit here better than in any other category of talking. My suggestion on how to talk to a member of the opposite sex for the first time, one you'd like to see more of, is simply be candid. In my case, being candid would mean saying, I'm not good at this. I don't strike up a conversation very well with a woman I've just met, but I'd enjoy talking with you a few minutes. My name's Larry. If she responds, you've got a conversation. If she doesn't, you're off the hook, because you know a conversation with her isn't going anywhere anyhow. Here's another approach I might use. Suppose I meet a woman at a small private dinner. I might say, you know, there really aren't any gimmicks for a man to start a conversation with a woman anymore. I can think of all those lines that men used to use to strike up conversations with a woman he just met. They don't work anymore. So how do we start talking to each other? Now, from that opening, you can proceed to the next step, getting a feel for the other person's interests so you can decide if you want to continue the conversation. You do it by simply mentioning a subject of interest to you. Well, everybody seems to have an opinion about this Menendez trial. What's yours? Or maybe, I just heard on the car radio coming over here that the stock market dropped another 58 points today. Do you think we are headed for another October 1987? Questions like these serve two purposes. They give you a follow-up subject to talk about after you've just introduced yourselves to each other, and they're a gauge of the intelligence and the interest of the other person. If the man you're talking to responds to the first question by saying, I was shocked to hear that verdict, that tells you that he probably follows some current events, is able to hold up his end of a conversation, may have something in common with you. But if he says, I don't know anything about that, he is telling you the exact opposite, which may mean you should look around for someone who's closer to your wavelength. Or if you're talking to a woman and she responds to the question about the stock market by saying, oh no, there was an article about that in the Wall Street Journal today, you know you've connected. But if she says, I never follow that stuff, it's boring, chances are you may find her boring too, and vice versa. My advice in meeting people, and especially in talk between the sexes, is to learn as much as you can about the other person as early in the conversation as possible. Engage them in areas that you're interested in and stick to your natural conversational style. If you're a witty, bantering sort of talker, see if she is too. If you're a woman who's on the serious side, see if he is. If you like politics or sports or movies or all of the above, see if he does. If he or she's not like you and isn't interested in the subjects that interest you, excuse yourself politely and then move on. There's bound to be someone else in the room that's more fun for you to talk to. I don't know what the percentage is, but we can assume that about half of the talking most of us do is in the course of our jobs. I'm primarily a broadcaster rather than a business executive, but I've taken part in enough business meetings as a speaker, panelist, chairman, or participant, and have talked with enough of America's top executives to have picked up some pointers that can help you in business talk. It will come as no surprise that every successful business person I can think of is an effective talker. In this section, I'll pass along the tips I've learned from them and from my own experiences, beginning with these three guidelines. First, the same basic principles apply in business talk as in social conversation. Be direct and open. Be a good listener if you want to be a good talker. The second guideline is that if you're talking within your own industry or profession, you can assume the people you're talking to know the technical terms you're using, but you still have to make yourself clear. And if you're talking to people outside your own field, you have to assume just the opposite, that the audience or the other meeting participants know nothing about the technical terms, so you must speak in lay language. And finally, time is money. Don't waste the time of the people you're talking to. Don't talk about last night's ball game or your last round of golf. until the end of the one-on-one lunch, and then try to cram the real purpose of the meeting into a hurried 5-minute discussion. And don't try to be the life of the meeting with a 20-minute monologue while everybody else is anxious to get down to business. This third point deserves elaboration. Don't you dread getting a phone call from someone you know is good for 25 minutes when you're trying to get a contract proposal out the door? Don't put yourself in the same category. Know what you're talking about. And whether it's a chat in a coworker's office or in a full-dress meeting, be prepared. Think ahead of time about the subject, what points you want to drive home, and what questions you can expect, and the most convincing way to answer them. And remember, what the other person wants and needs to know. For example, here's the kind of situation that crops up for all of us. If you need last month's sales figures, you ask Susan in sales for them. But you don't have to tell her the entire corporate marketing strategy for the next sales year. That is a waste of her time and yours. This doesn't mean you should be close-mouthed. One of the most effective ways of maintaining high morale and productivity among your employees is to keep them informed. So there will be times when you give people background information to make them feel involved or to motivate them. But you don't need to give a briefing every time you talk to somebody. You want to avoid that old complaint that if you ask so-and-so what time it is, he tells you how to watch works. Everybody is selling something. You're selling yourself and your education and experience every day in your job, whether you are actually a salesperson or something else. You may be listening to this tape because you want to sell yourself better. When it comes to selling, those who are successful in business talk get that way by obeying certain do's and don'ts. You have to learn your products or services and what works and doesn't work in selling them. The only way you can learn that is by talking to your colleagues and reading everything you can about the experiences of others. Many successful people have told me this same thing about the secret of successful sales. One such person is Jack Kent Cook, one of the richest men in America, who learned this at the tender age of 14. Jack's wealth has been estimated at between $600 million and $1 billion, and his holdings range from the Chrysler Building in New York to the Washington Redskins football team. We were having lunch at Duke Ziebert's restaurant in Washington when he told me of his first sale. It happened in 1931, the bottom of the Depression, when Jack was a kid in Canada and nobody had money to buy anything. It was no time to begin a career in sales. But Jack's mother needed $2.50 to pay the family phone bill, and she didn't have it. So Jack went out and got himself a job selling encyclopedias door to door. The books came with a kit telling you how to sell them successfully. With the wisdom and confidence of a 14-year-old, Jack ignored the tips, confident that he could make sales on the strength of his own charm and persuasiveness. Well, anyone who knows Jack Kent Cook knows he has plenty of both, but you need more than that, especially at 14. So he struck out, a miserable failure in his first experience at business talk with a store owner named Mr. Pickering. Then he decided to take a look at those instructions. He sat down and read them thoroughly, taking 2 hours out of his day to do it. In his approach to his second prospective customer, he hit the jackpot because he followed the suggestions in the sales kit. He closed the deal with the clincher question, "Where would you like us to ship the books?" Then he went back to Mr. Pickering, and the result was exactly the opposite of his first encounter with him. Pickering bought a set of the encyclopedias, too. By the end of the day, Jack was able to rush home and give his mother not just the $2.50 for the phone bill, but a whopping $24.50. "I think that was the proudest moment of my life," Jack says today, "including all our Super Bowls." He was successful because he followed two rules of sales. Know what you're selling, and once you've closed the deal, don't keep selling. When he asked that question about where to ship the books, he accomplished both. He clinched the deal, and he closed it too. There's another key rule in talking to make a sale. Sell the advantages of the product, not the features of the product. Don't talk about how the toaster has this dandy microchip for consistent doneness. Talk instead about sitting down to breakfast with a steaming cup of coffee and a golden brown English muffin. Don't talk about the premiums and payouts of the insurance policy. Talk about the security your client will feel and the gratitude of his and her spouse and children in knowing that the cornerstone of their financial future is in place. You'll never sell any product that is as important as yourself, so you want to do it right. Selling yourself in job interviews, in your performance on the job so you can earn a promotion, and in working with outsiders so you can make yourself attractive to other companies and thus increase your career progress and your earning power is your most basic selling job. Almost everybody in business must go through the process at least several times in his or her career. Having been through the same experience myself several times, I have my own four cardinal rules to follow. They've helped me, and they can help you too. First, show prospective employers what you can do for them. What do you bring that's unique? To paraphrase President Kennedy, ask not what your employer can do for you, but what you can do for your employer. Don't tell the person interviewing you what's on your resume, which they've already read. Tell them instead how you're going to do this job better than anybody else would. Make them think about how good the boss who hired you will look. In other words, sell your advantages, not your features. You do that by talking about your knowledge and your skills, the expertise and contacts you have developed in your field, the abilities you've developed over your own career. Second, maintain an open attitude. Openness is the quality that's essential in virtually every kind of social and business talk if you are to be successful. Don't be so businesslike in your demeanor that you stifle your openness. Communicate your enthusiasm for the job. This is a refreshing characteristic that employers don't always find in job interviews, and the applicant who displays it sometimes will find out later it was the one quality that made a difference. My own experience in getting my first job in radio in Miami is another case history. I had zero experience in broadcasting, zilch. But boy, did I have enthusiasm. The general manager of that radio station picked it up right away and decided that I was worth hiring, that here was a young man he could work with. Here was a good prospect. That was 37 years ago, and I'm still working in this profession for which he hired me with no experience. Third, be prepared. Go over the key points you want to make about yourself. Even jot them down on a yellow pad and review them several times before the interview. And don't duck hard questions. Put them down and then figure out how you're going to answer them. If you've changed jobs, say, three times in the past 7 years, expect to be asked why. And if you want to go that extra mile, put yourself through a dress rehearsal by having somebody play the role of your prospective employer and interview you. That's an extremely effective technique. One that'll give you a much better shot at getting that job. And finally, ask questions. Asking questions is how you learn, and in a job interview, you definitely want to learn about the company just as much as the company wants to learn about you. You'll never have a better opportunity to get a feel for your prospective company or boss. Besides, employers respect someone who displays the initiative to ask intelligent questions about the company. That shows that you possess two of the most persuasive qualities we just talked about. You're prepared and you care. When you're the interviewer instead of the interviewee, you should display some of the same characteristics you're looking for in a job applicant: openness, enthusiasm, caring, and a willingness to ask questions. Don't just concentrate on the person's qualifications. Draw them out. Are they enthusiastic? Will they care how they do the job? Remember that openness and enthusiasm are two-way streets. Be honest about the job and about yourself as a boss. And if you don't show enthusiasm for your company, why would anyone want to work there? Okay, you got the job. What about all the talking you're going to do now? It would be nice to say that we talk the same to everyone in every setting, including the workplace, but it doesn't work out that way. You talk to your boss differently than you talk to your peers or your subordinates. That's human nature, because by definition, your boss is not your peer. A second lieutenant in the Army is not going to talk to his commanding general the same way he talks to his fellow lieutenants. And he'll talk to the major, who is his immediate boss, in a friendlier, more informal way than he's going to talk to the general. It's appropriate to talk to your boss in a deferential way. All of us are aware of when we're talking to our boss, and our way of talking to him or her is different in tone and in manner, if not in words. But there's no need to talk like an apple polisher when speaking to the boss either. I don't talk that way to Ted Turner, and I don't know anybody else who does either. There's no need to be condescending or fawning, and many bosses will hold you in less regard if you do. In any job, and for many reasons, not just talking, it's helpful to know your boss. Not in a buddy-buddy, let's-have-a-drink-after-work way, But I would get to know him or her for the same good reasons it's helpful to know yourself in your job setting. Your role, your contributions to the company, your strong and weak points, where you should improve, and what your priorities are. Get to know the same thing about your boss. I know this from my own experiences with bosses. If things are going great, you don't have to worry about how to talk to your boss. But if you think something's wrong, something's wrong. Once again, listen to your instinct. So approach the boss in a completely open manner. Don't appear fearful or resentful of your boss's dissatisfaction. Instead, frame your dilemma like this. I have the feeling I could be doing my job more effectively. Can you help me understand what areas I should concentrate on? Or, I'm not sure I understand how to go about this project. It would help me if you explain what steps I should be taking first. If you do, you should be successful, unless your boss is completely paranoid or a jerk. If that's the case, you need to start looking for a new job, not just a new approach. The problem is with the boss, rather than you. In talking to your subordinates, there's a simple rule of thumb that works. Talk to those who work for you the same way you want your boss to talk to you. In large organizations, there are often formal employee evaluations, stating goals and objectives for each member of your staff. In a smaller one, the process may be handled less formally. But formal or not, such reviews are intended to accomplish exactly what we're talking about here, to guarantee that you talk to each of your employees on a regular schedule and tell them what kind of job they're doing, where you think they can do better, and what specifically you'd like for them to concentrate on in the following evaluation period. Personnel management people will tell you that the evaluation meeting to go over these points is also supposed to be a two-way street, that you should be willing to listen to what your employee has to say about you, the strong and weak points of the office's operation, and your role in it, and what they think you can and should do to make things run even better. Periodic evaluation meetings with members of your staff are only one method of communicating to your employees, not just talking to them. But don't just do this every 6 months. In the day-to-day working atmosphere, tell your employees how they're doing. Give clear instructions. If time is a factor, make sure they understand that and give them a deadline. Encourage them to ask questions so you can be sure that they understand. Be generous with your praise for good work. If you're unhappy with something, tell them. Don't avoid a confrontation by hoping the problem will dry up and blow away or solve itself. And don't postpone action for a week while your blood pressure goes through the top of your head and you wind up exploding at the employee. This is the Stone Age way of treating grown-ups, including those who work for you, and frequently causes a permanent rupture in your working relationship with that employee and the rest of your staff, too. Don't play games with your staff members either by expressing your displeasure to another subordinate of yours and using them to convey your message for you. Have the professionalism, the integrity, and the guts to do it yourself. The employees who used to be called secretaries or even Girl Fridays, why do I get the feeling I'm dating myself, are more often called assistants now. But whatever title they prefer, such employees are the secret weapon in many offices, the link that makes the whole operation successful. They save time, they get things done more effectively, not only for their bosses, but also their coworkers, and they can do the same for you. In my own case, people who work with me know that Judith Thomas, my personal assistant and one of my associate producers on the Larry King Live staff, is the first person to talk to about matters involving my schedule. Someone could spend a week trying to get me on the phone, but in almost every case, Judy can field that question herself and work you onto the calendar, a talent of which she is a genius. Show that you respect your assistant's competence and knowledge. A good assistant is an asset to any organization and deserves to be treated accordingly. Not only that, it's just being smart. An assistant who feels appreciated and gets talked to in the right professional way is going to go out of his or her way to help you and will move mountains to get things done for you. Negotiating is often a critical area of business talk. In addition to his many other talents, my friend Herb Cohen is a professional negotiator. He travels 200 days a year handling negotiations for the largest corporations in America. His book, You Can Negotiate Anything, was on the New York Times bestseller list for 9 months and was a bestseller in Australia for 3 years. He was an advisor to Presidents Carter and Reagan on counterterrorism. Herbie knows from negotiating. One of his first and greatest successes came at an early age when we were ninth graders at Bensonhurst Junior High School, ready to move on to Lafayette High. It's a textbook case, so to speak, of how you can turn a potential defeat into a victory in negotiations by making sure you talk from a position of strength, even when the odds are stacked high against you. Three of us, Herb Cohen, Brazzi Abadi, and I, had a classmate named Gil Mermelstein, called Mopo because he had such a thick head of red hair it looked like a mop. One day we discovered that he and his family had quickly moved to Arizona after Mopo developed tuberculosis. We took care of notifying the school. But Herb hatched a scheme where instead of telling them Mopo had moved, we would tell him Mopo died, collect money for flowers, and spend it all on hot dogs and soft drink at Nathan's, our favorite hangout. Unfortunately, our scheme succeeded too well. After the principal's office called Mopo's home and found his number had indeed been disconnected, the school mourned him enthusiastically, furnishing us with the loot for a massive feast at Nathan's. But it didn't stop there. The principal, Dr. Irving Cohen, no relation to Herbie, decided to establish the Gil Mermelstein Memorial Award for each year's outstanding student, singled us out for praise in honoring Mopo's memory the way we did with our collection. Mopo showed up at his own eulogy. As Dr. Cohen is praising Mopo's memory and our good deed, Mopo chooses that day and that minute to walk into the back of the auditorium. He was much better, thank you, and registering for the fall. Herbie jumps to his feet, cups his hands to his mouth, and yells, "Mopo, go home, you're dead!" Our fellow students, smelling a rat, break up in laughter. Dr. Cohen is not amused. What followed was teenage tension in its blackest moments, but also a triumph in negotiating. Dr. Cohen orders us to his office and proceeds to do the talking. "The three of you are suspended for life. You will never graduate. Not this year, not next year, not any year. You have pulled the most despicable act I have ever seen in a school." As Brazzi and I ponder life in prison with no parole, Herbie takes the offensive. He says to the principal, "Wait a minute, Doc. You are making a big mistake." "What'd you say?" "You're really going to kill your career if you do this." Dr. Cohen says, "What do you mean?" Herb continues, "It's true, we won't graduate, but how about you?" Then he moves in for the kill. "If you suspend us, there's going to be a hearing. At the hearing, one of the questions will be why you took the word of three 13-year-old boys who told you someone was dead. Why didn't you check the story out?" Dr. Cohen says, "We did check." Herbie continues, still brazenly calling him Doc instead of Doctor for his PhD degree. "Shouldn't you have done more than that, Doc? You made one phone call, the operator said the phone was disconnected, and on the basis of that one phone call you wrote, 'deceased' on his records? We have a bad disciplinary record already, and you make one phone call?" Then Herb made his closing argument. "Doc, we may be suspended, but you're out of work." Then, after pausing for effect, he says calmly, "Why don't we forget the whole thing?" Herb's negotiations were successful, resulting in a complete victory for all three of us, his first clients. Dr. Cohen agreed to forget the incident, and he also let us graduate. Whatever you might be negotiating for, my advice, based on personal experience, is to talk the language of Bob Wolf. It's no accident that Bob represented some of the greatest names in American entertainment, sports, and news media. Clients came to him and adversaries respected him because he spoke the same way he dealt, with integrity, professionalism, and humor. That's why I was always proud to tell people, "My agent is Bob Wolf." I always felt that it spoke well of me to be able to say that someone as respected as Bob represented me. Bob never spoke in threats or with hostility. He considered the party we were negotiating with to be our worthy adversary, but not our mortal enemy. He spoke to them the same way. He never believed in telling the Boston Celtics, "If you don't give Larry Bird what he wants, I'll tell him not to report to training camp." He didn't believe in walking out on a contract or even threatening to. He never told Ted Turner, "If you don't give us what we're asking for, you will have to air a rerun of Larry King Live tonight because I will see he is not there." He was perfectly willing, however, to make it clear that we had other options, and did on many occasions, but he never used the sledgehammer approach in which you threaten to destroy the other party. That wasn't Bob's nature, and it wasn't his way. He never believed in costly short-term victories. He used to remind me that if you make a few more bucks in the short run, but you've permanently alienated the other side, this will be the last contract you'll ever get out of them, that your victory is shallow, short-term. Herb Cohen has that same philosophy. That's my final advice on how to talk during negotiations, from my own experience and my frequent conversations with many experts. Keep your fences mended so you can win again the next time. That's one of the many lessons to be learned from these two highly successful negotiators. If you do what they do and talk their talk, as I've been able to describe that to you in this section, you'll be successful today and tomorrow, too. Everybody likes to complain about meetings, so somebody needs to stick up for them. There's this much to be said about meetings. When several people have to make decisions or plan how to get something achieved, a good meeting is the best and most efficient way to do it. A bad meeting, as we all know, is torture. A few simple points about meetings. When you're a participant, the best way to save time is simple. Don't go. If your presence is not really necessary, ask to be excused or invent a conflicting engagement. If you do go, an important guideline to remember is the less said, the better. Once you're there, if you are not involved in a topic under discussion, avoid the temptation to jump into the conversation just for the sake of being noticed. Be willing to ask dumb questions. Meetings have a tendency to develop sort of a bandwagon personality when one person states a certain premise early in the meeting and everybody else around the table spends the rest of the meeting jumping on the bandwagon. What you need then is someone who is willing to stop the runaway bandwagon by injecting a much-needed question like, "But isn't the emperor going to get cold standing there naked?" Now, if you know ahead of time that you're expected to speak, or if you feel strongly about wanting to say something in particular, make notes beforehand. Don't wing it. If you do, I can guarantee you'll talk too long and risk losing the support of your colleagues around the table. The reason you'll run longer is simply that you will digress. You'll hem, you'll haw, you'll say, too many times, and in general, will make it a far less effective presentation. By all means, don't be afraid to use humor. Meetings cry out for a laugh once in a while, especially if they're dragging on and no one is willing to adjourn the deliberations. I know a man in Washington who suffered through a long and boring meeting on the growing practice of converting rental apartments into condominiums in the early 80s. After the meeting dragged well beyond the productive point and seeing that the executive director was unwilling to wield the gavel, this guy says with a straight face, "As a Roman Catholic, I'm opposed to the use of condominiums." Whereupon the meeting broke up. When you're running the meeting, you will do well to remember what they say in the real estate business. The three most important things are location, location, and location. The three most important things in running a meeting are preparation, preparation, and preparation. So have an agenda, even if it's an informal one, consisting of just a few notes in front of you to make sure you cover what you want to cover in that meeting. This will considerably enhance your chances of meeting your objective by coming out of the meeting with what you want. Your prospects of having a successful meeting start with your own preparation. Then there are these other helpful hints. First, start on time. It sounds basic, but think of how many meetings you've been to that didn't. Let the small talk get finished in the hallway before and after the meeting. If you allow last night's football game to be the first subject of discussion at the table, you have no momentum for a brisk, decisive, productive meeting. The same applies to letting people drift in for the first 10 or 15 minutes. Then, be decisive. You've established what the issues are. The last question for each item is, what action is to be taken? Who's going to do it? If you leave this vague, there was no point in having the meeting in the first place. And finally, be firm. Don't let others waste time or try to score points on each other. You don't have to chide them. Let the clock do it. Just say, "Sorry, Pete, we got to move on to the next item." There's no reason for you to be afraid of seeming bossy or brusque. Relax. If you can run a short meeting and get decisions made, you'll earn far more gratitude and goodwill than you would be letting everybody ramble and then presiding over a failed meeting. That helps you in no way. Somebody tells you you have to give a speech. Your response may be, "I gotta do what?" But it's important to remember that speeches are like anything else in life. There's always a first time. People, even some who are wonderful talkers in a conversational setting, are often terrified over the prospect of giving their first speech. Some are scared about it regardless of how many they give. We seem to believe that there's some kind of mystique to public speaking, some secret knowledge that makes a person a good speaker. There are so many books on the subject, you'd think you needed a graduate degree before you could stand at a lectern. I give speeches many times a year to groups of every possible description. My secret is simply that I think of public speaking as no different from any other form of talk. It's a way of sharing my thoughts with other people. In one sense, it's easier than social conversation because you are in complete control of where the talk is going. At the same time, you have to have something to say. You can't fudge it with, "Oh, really, tell me more." And saying you have to go to the bathroom does not get you out of this one. This leads to the first key to being a successful public speaker. Talk about something you know about. Find a subject that you know about, or take a personal approach to a broader subject. If your church group or synagogue asks you to give a talk on your trip to the Holy Land, don't try to make a grand summary of the meaning of the Israeli PLO peace treaty. Tell about what you saw and how the political situation affected people you met and talked to. I guarantee you, you'll be more comfortable and your listeners will find it a lot more interesting. When I made my first speech at the age of 13, I picked a subject that was very close to me. It was my bar mitzvah, the coming-of-age ceremony for a Jewish boy. We didn't have much money then. My father had just died 3 years before, and my mother was in the process of working hard to get us off welfare, which she accomplished shortly thereafter. But she made sure my brother and I had our bar mitzvahs. On those occasions, the young man being honored is required to make a speech. I had never stood up in front of an audience before, except during those recitals and book reports that every kid gives in school. But this was a real audience, with grown-ups yet. At 13, you're not an expert on very many things, so I decided to talk about one of the things I knew the most about. My father. Most everybody in the audience had known him, and I shared my memories with them. I recalled my walks and talks with my father down Howard Avenue to Saratoga Park, where he would buy me ice cream. I told my audience that our talks there were more fun and more important to me than the park itself or the ice cream. He talked to me about the Yankees with Joe DiMaggio, about going to Lou Gehrig's funeral. He'd ask me what I learned in Hebrew school that day, and he told me how glad he was to be in America, not in Russia, where he had emigrated from when he was 20 years old. Some of the adults said nice things to me after I finished my speech, and I found I had enjoyed sharing my memories with them. It was one of the experiences that convinced me I wanted to talk for a living. The second key to being a good speaker is to follow the motto of the Boy Scouts: be prepared. If you're talking about a subject you know well, as I've just advised, preparing the speech itself should not be too difficult. You will be able to organize your thoughts more easily and more effectively if you bear in mind this simple structure for speeches. 1. Tell them what you're going to tell them. 2. Tell them. 3. Tell them what you've told them. If you let the audience know where you're going at the beginning, they'll follow you more easily through the body of your speech. At the end, try to summarize your most important points in slightly different words from the ones you used in the opening. I'm lucky because I give speeches often enough I don't have to spend much time in preparation. When I'm asked to speak these days, the audience usually wants to know about a subject I'm very familiar with. But unless you're giving a speech on a topic you've already spoken about before, preparation is a must. You can prepare any number of ways, whichever way works best for you. You can write your speech out word for word, read it from the text. Many speakers do that. If you follow this approach, be sure to practice reading your speech enough so you can look at your audience frequently and you don't spend the entire speech with your eyes on the paper in front of you. Others prefer speaking from an outline, typed on standard 8.5x11 typing paper. Still others are most comfortable with notes on file cards. The advantage of using notes is that you tend to speak with more spontaneity and you don't fall into that trap of staring down at a script. But speaking is like body language and dressing. Whatever you're most comfortable with is what you should do. Now, whether you use a script or notes, you should practice your speech several times to get familiar with the content, become comfortable with the style and the pacing. You can read it in front of a mirror or ask a coworker or someone in your family to be the audience for this rehearsal. It's a good idea to time yourself as you're rehearsing. Your speech may take much more or much less time than you think while you're writing it. You should find out how much time you're allotted before you speak and adjust your speech in rehearsal as necessary to fill that time. Here are some other key tips based on my own speaking experience and what I've noticed in other good speakers. Look at your audience. I've already said how important it is to make eye contact. First, be sure to look up from your text or notes. Second, don't talk to the wall in the back of the window or the side. They are not the audience. Each time you look up from your text, look at a different part of the audience so the whole group feels they're being addressed. Know the pacing and inflection you want to use. Some speakers, if they're reading from a complete text, underline the words they want to emphasize. If you're using an outline or notes, highlight ideas or phrases you should stress. This accomplishes two things. It guarantees your emphasis will be where you intended it to be, and it assures the audience that you won't be speaking in a dull monotone that'll put them to sleep, especially if you're talking after a meal. Stand up straight. I don't mean you have to assume a parade ground posture, but stand in a comfortable way rather than hunching over the lectern. Hunching constricts your breathing, and it looks bad. If there's a microphone in front of you, adjust it to the right height or ask a technician to do it, rather than forcing yourself to stoop like a heron. If you can, check this out before it's your turn to speak. Talk normally into the microphone. That's why it's there. If you declaim at a high volume into it, you'll actually be harder to hear. And be careful to keep your mouth in range of the mic. Don't weave around or turn away to answer a question from the side. Now, unless you're announcing a cure for cancer or declaring war, it helps to remember that speeches are considered by some to be the curse of mankind. Don't stay serious if you don't have to. And even if you're talking on a serious subject, most listeners welcome shots of humor. Suppose you're talking to a group of business executives about strategies and how to carry them out. This is one of my favorite stories on that subject. Will Rogers said he had a plan for ending World War I. He used to say, as I see it, the problem is caused by all them German submarines, the U-boats, sinking our boats. I propose we heat the Atlantic Ocean to the boiling point. Then, when the ocean gets too hot for them German subs to stay underwater, they'll have to come to the surface. And when they do, we'll be waiting for them and pick them off one by one, just like we do during hunting season back home in Oklahoma. Then Rogers added, "Of course, you might ask me how I'm going to heat the Atlantic Ocean to 212 degrees Fahrenheit, and my answer is, I leave it to technicians. Me, I'm a policy man." After the laughter dies down, you draw the connection between the story and the point you're making. You tell your audience, "Now that's the difference between setting policy and implementing it." Here's an example on the subject of problem solving, a serious concern with many business and professional audiences. You can quote the genius of my friend Jackie Gleason on that subject. He had a proposal for solving the traffic problem in New York City. Make all the streets one way north, then let Albany worry about it. After the laughter, you relate the joke to the point you're making by adding, "Gleason's approach is a good reminder not to make your problem solving approaches more complicated than necessary." If you remember that public speaking is just a modified form of conversation and talk in your natural style, you know people are going to understand you. They will feel you're talking to them, not over their heads. Don't go too far the other way and try to be too colloquial. Even in this permissive 90s, four-letter words and other examples of appealing to the lowest common denominator in your audience hurt you a whole lot more than they may help you. If you're a Marine whose everyday talk is full of expletives, here's where to adjust your normal speech. Even if a given listener doesn't mind that you say damn, he's going to be uncomfortable if he knows that your language is bothering, say, his grandmother across the aisle. It's a different matter if you know your audience intimately, say you're talking to your platoon. But unless that's the case, err on the side of decorum in your speech. Keep in mind the value of brevity. English teachers tell the story of the man who received a lengthy letter from a friend who ended with an apology. "Please excuse such a long letter," his friend said. "I didn't have time to write a short one." It's not easy to be brief, especially on a topic you know a lot about. But in any kind of communication, it's always worth taking the time to boil your message down to its essentials. That emphasis on brevity applies even more when you're delivering a speech. The show business expression, "know when to get off," comes into play again. And the best public speakers always know when. Abraham Lincoln knew it. His Gettysburg Address lasted less than 5 minutes. He was preceded on that November day in 1863 by one of the most popular orators of the time, Edward Everett. He spoke for 2 hours. We know which speech is remembered today. Everett knew greatness when he heard it. He later wrote to Lincoln, I should be glad if I could flatter myself that I come as near to the central idea of the occasion in 2 hours as you did in 2 minutes. Some of the longest speeches ever inflicted on the American public have been the inaugural addresses of our presidents. However, one of the shortest inaugural addresses is also one of the best remembered and most often quoted. It was delivered January 20th, 1961 by John F. Kennedy. The new president offered a challenge to Americans as they moved into a new decade following the 50s, which many considered a lethargic time. Carl Sandburg, the eminent author, poet, and historian who won the Pulitzer Prize for his account of Lincoln's presidency, told friends of his admiration for the Kennedy inaugural address. He said, "It's Lincoln-esque." Kennedy spoke for less than 15 minutes. Most of us will never find ourselves in the position of leader of the free world, but our speeches are important to ourselves and to our audiences. We can learn from these speakers whose ability to talk effectively was central to their success, as is the case with so many successful people in every profession. Brevity is the first thing we can learn from them. If people like Lincoln and Kennedy are willing to keep it short to maximize their effectiveness as speakers, we should be smart enough to do the same thing. These great speakers also adhered to another fundamental rule of good speaking. It's summarized in the expression K-I-S-S, KISS. It means, keep it simple, stupid. There are no 50-cent words, no trendy talk, no convoluted sentences, no technical terms in these moving speeches by these two world figures. Follow their example, and even if you are no Kennedy, you'll get your message across. That's what makes an effective speaker. If you become successful at speaking in public, the next thing that might befall you is to find yourself being asked to appear on radio or TV. Don't panic. I think of my nightly CNN show as a conversation that happens to be in front of a camera. I don't think of it as a confrontation. In this, I differ from some other interviews like Sam Donaldson. I don't feel you have to come at your guest in attack mode or like a prosecuting attorney to get a solid, substantive answer. I prefer to be civil about it, to engage my guest on a personal level, in so doing to conduct an interview that is both informative and interesting viewing. Careful listening and persistent questioning are often the key. I was doing my Miami radio show on the Surfside 6 nightclub boat when Joe DiMaggio Jr. walked in with a friend. My guest was Bill Hartack, the Hall of Fame jockey. After interviewing Bill, Joe Jr. came onto the show and we talked for half an hour about his life as the son and namesake of one of the most famous people in America. As we talked, we moved logically, almost naturally, into the subject of his relationship with his father. Finally, I asked him the most fundamental question that can be asked of a human being about his parents. Do you love your father? Joe Jr. thought for a very long time. I love what he's done. Do you love him? Again, silence. And then, I don't know him. I'm sure Joe had his side of that story about his relationship with his son. If he were to come on my show, I would give him the opportunity to talk about it. But knowing Joe's rigid refusal to talk about his personal life, I'm sure he would decline the invitation. If my question about his father had been the first one I'd asked Joe DiMaggio Jr., he probably would have given a standard answer like, of course. But when I came to it after a comfortable time, as part of a reasonable and discreet conversation, he gave a much more honest and more poignant answer. However, your first experience with a broadcast interview is more likely to feature you as the interviewee rather than the host. Think of the Boy Scouts again and be prepared. In any interview, the first secret of success is to make sure you control the interview, not the other person, whether it's a job interview or a newspaper story or you on the radio. You can gain control by making certain you have a thorough knowledge of the subject and then reminding yourself that you know more about it than the person across the desk or microphone from you. If it's a news interview, remember, there's nothing in the United States Constitution that requires you to answer every question or to go into as much detail as your questioner might like or even to be interviewed in the first place. And as in so many other things, diverting the question with humor when you've been put on the spot often makes the interview successful. You can't be forced into answering anybody's questions, including mine, unless you're sitting as a witness in a courtroom or giving a deposition in a court case. And even in a judicial proceeding, if you can't remember something, Don't let the fact that you're so nervous lead you into giving an answer that won't stand up and lay to testimony by you or others. If you don't remember, say so. They can never send you to jail for not being able to remember something. If you weren't there, say so. But remember this, if you were there and you say you weren't, you're asking for trouble. Public humiliation or worse, legal penalties. Always tell the truth, obviously, and never be afraid to say you don't remember, if that's the truth. If you're being interviewed in any other setting, including news interviews, don't worry about the questions. If you don't like the question, you can divert it any number of ways, even on Larry King Live, corporate executives, government officials, celebrities, even my own colleagues in broadcasting, employ some of the following ways of getting out of answering a question they don't like, for one legitimate reason or another. For example, it would be premature for me to answer that question now, or I'm not able to answer that question because I haven't seen the report yet. One of the worst answers in a news interview is no comment. That used to work, although never very well. It doesn't work at all now. In this litigious society and with the tabloid mentality that seems to be overtaking this society, or at least disturbingly significant portions of it, no comment now implies guilt. If he wasn't guilty, he wouldn't say no comment. He'd answer the question. The only time you hear it anymore is in a badly written television or movie script. What if you know in advance that you're walking into an uncomfortable situation, but you have to do it anyway? What then? Answer, be honest. Example, Tylenol. When it was learned in the 80s that someone had tampered with Tylenol's product by lacing its capsules with poison, the manufacturer Johnson & Johnson took the straight-up attitude rather than trying to minimize the impact of what it had found or by trying to stage a cover-up. Officials went before the television cameras and apologized to the American consumers. Their public relations approach, in essence, was not to use a public relations approach. They told the truth. This awful thing has happened, but our product remains safe. We've taken extraordinary new precautions to minimize the possibility that could ever happen again, and you can continue to buy Tylenol without fear. The result was that public confidence in that product was restored, and the company won respect all over the country for its forthrightness. Here are five tips that I've picked up from my own experiences and from talking to others in broadcasting that will help you survive and succeed on radio and television. First, stick with what makes you comfortable. One of the secrets for a successful performance in representing yourself, your company, or your organization on radio or television is to make sure you're comfortable with what you're doing. And if you don't want to be interviewed, don't. Second, stay current. Remain young in the sense that you stay current. Know what TV shows and movies are popular, who the favorite singers and actors are. Have a working familiarity, not necessarily an expert's knowledge, on the stories of the day and what news people are talking about. In the 50s and 60s and later, we had to know a little something about the Cold War. Now we have to know about its end. We used to need to be conversant about the Soviet Union. Now we also have to be able to talk, to some extent, about Bosnia. That's one of the major reasons President Clinton has appeared on MTV. Clinton agrees to go on that show not just to stay current, but to show he's current, that he knows the interests and concerns of America's youth. Third, avoid negatives. Don't worry that you might not do well. If you concentrate on negatives, your performance will be negative. Remind yourself that your appearance on this show or your answers in the interview, although they may be important to you and maybe to many others, will probably not change the course of civilization as we know it. John Lowenstein, a talented Major League Baseball player for 16 years and now a broadcaster for the Baltimore Orioles telecast, was once asked by a reporter about his failure to lay down a bunt at a decisive point in that night's Orioles game. Lowenstein told the reporter, "Look, there are a billion people living in China, and tomorrow morning, not one of them will know that I missed that bunt." So, relax. Fourth, approach radio and TV the same way. On television, your appearance is important. On radio, it isn't. Beyond that, approach them the same way. I'm a communicator, a verbal communicator. I look at my guests on radio the same way I look at them on television. On TV, I let the camera follow me. I don't follow it. Because appearance is not important on radio, I often wear jeans. Never on television. And fifth, improve your voice and look your best. On both radio and television, your voice is important. Maybe it shouldn't be, but it is. Your speaking voice projects distinction and authority. I'm lucky to have been born with what is considered a good voice for broadcasting. I've never had to worry about it. But if I didn't have the voice I've been given, I would seek to improve it, even if I never went on the air for anything. It's too much of a factor in success. It has been said that President Clinton would project a more persuasive image if he had a stronger, deeper voice, although I don't know how anyone could be more impressive on television than he is. He's our best TV president since Kennedy, and I include Reagan. In any profession, if I thought my voice could stand improving, I would find a voice teacher there in every city, or read books in the library, or do both. I know from others in broadcasting that voice training works, and so do voice exercises. No matter what the quality of your voice is like, your delivery is very important. If you sound too much like Don Knotts, or if people tell you you don't talk loud enough, or you talk too fast, work on it. Slow yourself down, which will in turn calm you down. The best way to do that is to get used to the sound of your own voice. And that's another key ingredient in determining your success or failure on radio and television. The first time you heard yourself on a tape recording, even if it was only to record the message on your telephone answering machine, when you played it back, "I know what you said. I sound awful." The truth of the matter is that everyone thinks and says the same thing the first time they hear their own voice. So, if you're going to go on radio and television, you should make sure you're comfortable with the sound of your voice. How? By talking out loud, the same way many speakers do in rehearsing a speech. Practice answering imaginary questions, or have someone conduct a dry run with you, the same way experienced leaders in business and government do before they appear on a broadcast or at a press conference. Get used to what you sound like and develop your own pace in speaking, one that comes naturally to you and helps to make you more comfortable. You'll feel much calmer and more assured when you go on the air, which will greatly enhance your chances for a successful, persuasive performance. When you're on television, your appearance becomes extremely important because you're representing not only someone else but yourself, too. So you want to wear a good-looking suit or dress and make sure you're well-groomed, even down to such basics as clean fingernails. If your hair looks great, and so does the rest of you, you will represent yourself and your organization effectively, especially on TV. Some people are afraid that with so much information being carried on in so many electronic media, the art of conversation is going to become obsolete. I'd say exactly the opposite. We're talking more than ever, and in more ways than ever, because of all those new devices. But conversation will be with us as long as there are humans. And with all the inventions and Star Wars developments before us, success will always come back to the basics. Whether you are sitting across a table from somebody or typing messages across a computer network, the principles of good talk are the same. It's all about making a connection with the other person. Openness, enthusiasm, and a willingness to listen will make you a popular conversationalist in any medium. And whether you're talking to 12 people in a community center or giving a satellite teleconference, it's the same with addressing a group. Preparation, knowing your audience, keeping it simple, will always make you a successful speaker. If there's one thing I hope you get out of this tape, it's an attitude about talk. Talk should not be a challenge, a grim obligation, or a way of filling up time. Talk is mankind's greatest invention. It's how we make connections. It's one of the pleasures that life has to offer. Think of every conversation as an opportunity. Regardless of your ability as a talker, remember this. One, if you feel you're not good at it, you can be. And two, if you feel you are good at it, you can be better. Keep talking.
This has been a Random House Audiobooks presentation.